last century, I arrived in Nairobi in Kenya, and or as it was in those days, now Kenya, and was brought up there for the first 15 years of my life. In addition to which, my father, who, when I was first born, was a district commissioner up in the northern frontier part, soon after that, about 2 or 3 years into my life, became warden of the national park in Nairobi. So I had the huge privilege of growing up in the middle of a national park.
Hi, I'm Nick.
I am Bonsu.
And I'm Bryn. And this is Chalk It Up, a podcast that celebrates all things Sussex through stories and conversations with inspiring local people. This week, we have the real privilege of speaking to Peter Ellis, who lives in Wadhurst in East Sussex. Peter was born in Kenya in 1949, and he spent his childhood growing up in Nairobi National Park. And Peter shared loads of wonderful stories and experiences with us, and we hope you enjoy listening to them as much as we did.
Last century, I arrived in Nairobi in Kenya, and or as it was in those days, now Kenya, and was brought up there for the first 15 years of my life. Mm-hmm. In addition to which, my father, who, when I was first born, was a district commissioner up in the northern frontier part, soon after that, about 2 or 3 years into my life, became warden of the national park in Nairobi. So I had the huge privilege of growing up in the middle of a national park.
Wow.
That's excellent.
How long has that national park been a national park?
It came into existence post-war. So I think 48, 47, around about then. Prior to that, it had been the training ground for British troops or Commonwealth troops, really, moving up into Somalia and throwing the Italians out of there, which my father had been part of. But the government of the time realised that actually they needed to conserve areas of the country for the benefit for the future and designated a lot of national parks at that time, with more to come in following years.
Yeah.
So, and how old are you when you moved there?
I was born there, Bryn.
You
I
were
was
born
actually,
there.
Yeah, I was born in Nairobi. My father was up in Isiolo, and which is about 200 miles or so more going north. And I found his diary not so long ago, and it has an entry on my birthday. And it says, Eunice, his wife, delivered a boy. And that's as much as excitement as he could get into.
No, wait, where did you find his diary, his journal?
Just going through some papers that I took off him when he, you know, at the end of his life, and had been lying around, and I literally found this diary, and I thought, well, I'll have a flick through this. And I have to say, he's a man of very few words.
But interesting that he still kept a journal. Was that a sort of a functional thing?
I think it is. He was he himself was born in Kenya in 1907, and he was actually the first child to be christened in one of the churches in Nairobi. So he was the number one kid that got in the baptism size of it. Yes, I mean, he trained. When he actually got into work, he trained in accountancy and that sort of thing. So he's fairly meticulous about figures and keeping dates and things like that.
Particularly the number of his children.
Yes, yes, and the sex of them.
And did you check your brother's, both of your brother's dates as well, to see if they were if he was waxing as lyrical about them as he was about you?
Bryn, you've caught me out. I'm only interested in myself, for goodness sake.
Well, you don't want to spoil it for David and Richard.
Exactly.
You
know? When the time's appropriate, I'll tell him what he actually said about him. In fairness, my older brother, he's 8 years older than me, was born during the war, and by the time he came along, Dad had gone to war, so he was in Somalia when he arrived. So doubtful that I'll find any evidence of what he said at that point. But yeah, I must check on Dave's.
And what was going to school like there in Nairobi? Was it in Nairobi City that you went to school?
It was, yeah. I have distinct memories of the kindergarten. I can remember that one Christmas, Father Christmas arrived by helicopter, which was fantastic. That's really interesting way to arrive. But yeah, after that, went on to Nairobi Primary School, which was a mixed school, and it was predominantly, unless you lived in Nairobi, you were a boarder there. So from the age of about seven, I was boarding at the school. By and large, I quite enjoyed it.
Is it this boarding school? I mean, you hear a lot of things about boarding schools, especially in you know, in the 50s and 60s. Yeah. And was it anything like that? I mean,
absolutely.
Is it a tough place to go, to grow up?
I think it was. I mean, the prefect had what were known as doggies, which was a junior little kid that had to run around and do whatever he told him.
Right, okay.
And that sort of thing. And all of the teachers walked around either with a slipper in their top pocket for...
Just keep you in line.
Exactly. And there were some that you really didn't want to fall foul of, because there was one guy, I distinctly remember him, a Mr. Litchfield, had seven children of his own, and he played incredibly good squash, and he had a really mean wrist, so you didn't want to fall foul of him.
He'd give you a whack.
He could, and you felt it.
Yeah.
Whereas others, you kind of... Yeah, that was all right.
That's interesting. I mean, if I could get a bit of a background on where you were living in. So, born in Kenya.
Yeah.
You would have lived with, you know, expatriates. You would have, or the army. Were you in a camp? Or were you, or you know, what sort of context?
The home was literally in the middle of the national park. There was only another family of Europeans there, and then we had all of the African guys who were either rangers or working on the park. You know, there's a whole host of industries going on there. Because it was totally self-sufficient.
Yeah.
Road making, dam building, etc., etc., etc. So yeah, we were out on a limb in that it wasn't a case of you want to play with the kids; it had to be with the jolly girls that lived next door, and that was it. Your choice was limited to that. Other than, of course, we played with the African kids as well. So
So you said going to boarding school would have been about 200 kilometers from your. From where you live?
No, I've painted the wrong picture. The actual school, Nairobi National Park, is outstanding in that on one end of it you've got skyscrapers, literally coming up to the border of where the park is now. It wasn't so the case in those days, but you could always see in the far distance one or two skyscrapers, giving you the actual. Giving you the actual backdrop of the park. So we were about, I suppose, 20 kilometres or so.
Right.
In those days, were pretty basic roads.
Yes,
so when it rained, it got a bit tough to get
there. Yeah, yeah. So you and your siblings all went to the boarding school, take it, and you obviously mixed up with a huge number of African kids. So
in those days it was very segregated.
Right.
So our primary school was totally whites.
Yeah. Right.
With a broad spectrum of kids. I mean, a lot of the ones that were there probably a fair number came from South Africa.
Right.
Come up with the farming community. Then there would be the guys, the families that had settled in Kenya,
yeah,
which is where my dad came in, and there was a contingent of people who were there for 2 or 3 years,
yeah,
working for BP or Shell or sort of things, yeah, or for the government coming in for 5 years and then they were off again.
Right. So it's more, it's only when you've probably come back to the national park, then you tend to be able to mix up with your friends who are from Africa.
Absolutely. In a way. The moment we were home, you just played with whoever's around.
No, I mean, I went to boarding school myself, you know, so I kind of understand the, and our boarding school was run by the British, but by the time we were there, probably maybe 90% of the teachers in the school was actually run by Ghanaians, not that. But we did have a lot of, obviously, expatriates there as well who were coming into the school. I find it quite interesting because that time is such a, if you like, there were loads and loads of things going on in terms of after the war, in terms of Kenya being developed. I think it was still under the colonial rule.
All the way up until 63.
Yeah.
You're right. It was a really interesting time. My dad always contended that he had the best of Africa from a white man's perspective, mm-hmm, being a young man between the two wars.
Yeah.
The place was pretty well virgin.
Yeah.
You could do what you like. And he reckons that was the best time for the Europeans. With my arrival and soon after... Kenya went through the Mau Mau, it did impact in a minor way, particularly on the parents. But as kids, it became part of life.
Yeah,
you would always have to go through military roadblocks. They would check the cars for weapons, etc., etc. And we, because we were an isolated house. And community, and my father had an armory there because, mm-hmm, from time to time he had to shoot particular animals or whatever.
Yeah.
There were attempts made on getting into the house and trying to get the weapons from us.
Yeah.
There were 3 attempts made, and of course, because we were very close to Nairobi, people could just melt away into the background of Nairobi and not be so easily to find. But all 3 occasions were fooled by the African Rangers.
Yeah.
The first 2 occasions, they literally picked up the footprints of the guys moving into the forest with a view to coming down in the evening and bringing in an attack. But so instantly we knew there was trouble and called in the army. They'd do a sweep and it'd just go back to normal. And the 3rd attempt... they'd got wise to the fact that they had to get across the roads without the rangers being able to pick up the sights of their footprints. And they pole vaulted over. But one of them just didn't quite make it. From my point of view, take your point of view, Bryn. So he just fell short and left 1 footprint behind, and that was enough for these guys to pick up on it, and another sweep went through.
Brilliant.
And the 3rd time?
That was the third. But as a youngster, it was different in that the parents were a lot more edgy about security. Mm. Every window had bars on it. And as youngsters, we were told that there were certain things you must never, ever do if you wake up in the middle of the night. And they have what they call polecat thieves, where with a very long stick and a hook, they would lift things out.
Mm.
And to begin with, people said, all you've got to do is grab it. Well, to stop people doing that, they put razor blades along the edges. Yeah. So you were told, don't ever do that. And at a very, quite a young age, we became competent with using weapons.
My
father used to do his regular job as warden of the national park, and then two or three nights a week he'd go into Nairobi as a special constable and do patrols through there in trying to track down the Mau Mau.
Could I just ask about the Mau Mau?
Because
I feel a bit ignorant here, because I heard of them, and I'm assuming it's like an uprising of sorts. But maybe, could know a little bit more about they were and what were they after?
They were after independence.
Are they the local Kenyan people, or is it more complex?
It's a bit more complex than that. Kenya's got something like 50-odd tribes, and together with the same number of languages. And some are very well associated, and some have hated each other historically. So in pre-colonial times, the hunter-gatherer Maasai were predominant across huge swathes of East Africa, generally. But as the Europeans came in, some of the more industrious tribes rose up, and top of them were the Kikuyu and their associate tribes that went with them. And they're, the Kikuyu are a very bright bunch and actually got on quite well under the new regime, but at the same time were the ones that were really pushing for independence. Jomo Kenyatta was the titular head, and he did his work in the UK and then ended up in prison in Kenya. And he was more—he was a political man, but there was a military wing. And the military wing in really early 50s, 52, 53, around there, started attacking lonesome farms and things like that. And the response by the settlers, as we were known as in those days, was instant and bloody. But the UK government stopped it getting out of control and brought in the army. And then there was a long number of years of attritional warfare to the point that the only way that the government felt that they could contain the situation was they put all the Kikuyus, who used to be dotted around all over the place, their houses were all, they put them in huge compounds and then patrolled the compounds and made sure that the freedom fighters couldn't really operate without somebody snitching or whatever, so that they could step on it, which then put the fighters into the forests and other places. In reality, they were never going to win, but they could win the political argument. And actually, in the end, they did. Eventually, they got to independence, which is what they were after. But it was a bloody affair. They were doing their best with homemade weapons and things like that. They were also up against the other tribes who the Brits were quite happy to take on board and use to sweep through the forests and try and flush them out and things like that. And one of my earliest memories is actually of hearing bombers flying out and hearing bombs being dropped on Mount Kenya several miles away, which in reality was complete and utter waste of time, because these were only small groups of guys, but it was just really the terror tactics as was used then. The bottom line in the body count side of thing is less than 100 Europeans were killed, excluding military. So of the people that lived in Kenya, less than 100 of them were killed, whereas about something like 20,000 Kikuyu were killed. Jesus. And that was an awful lot of actual black on black and Kikuyu on Kikuyu, because they had some very fearsome ways of getting people into their armies, so the body count was pretty high, and I don't think there was much in the way of prisoners on either side, shall we say. It was a very bloody affair, particularly for the Africans, and eventually it did peter out, and things got back to some sort of normality in the late 50s, early 60s.
And you would have been how old around then?
Well, during the height of the Mau Mau, I was only about 3, 4, 5, 6.
Okay. So when did you first become aware of this, and how did that... how aware of it were you growing up, and how did you feel about it all?
I think it came in at two levels when I think about it. There's one which was, as I was saying, you got used to the roadblocks, you got used to the fact that Mum slept with a pistol underneath her pillow, and Dad wasn't there two nights a week because he was on patrol in Nairobi. But then on the other side of it, as youngsters, you know, when the parents were around having tea and chatting with others, it was all about, well, what are you going to do about what? What's the future going to be? What is the future going to be? You know, there was talk in those days of doing what they did in Rhodesia and going to, you know, declare independence and we'll run the country the way we are, against which there were an awful lot of people thinking, well, actually, I'm just going to go back to the UK or Netherlands or wherever it was and get on with my life there. But there were a number of people who seriously wanted to fight against independence. But in fairness, I think that the colonial government was of a decent enough standard to retreat slowly. Do you know what I mean? Without compromising people along the way. And eventually, you know, the talking was around getting the independence sorted out. And, of course, we ended up with Jomo Kenyatta coming in. Again, as we ran towards independence, there was, again, a lot of tension, tribal tension. We had one set of the African tribes in one camp and one set in another. And there was an awful lot of bloodshed then, which wasn't really very well covered. Which raised to tensions across everything. And that was a more lawless time because the Brits didn't want to be seen as dictating and taking too much control. And at the same time, the police were having a bloody hard time trying to keep people apart. And, of course, the crime level went up at the same time. Yeah. So it was a hiding to nothing for the authorities. And then independence came. And it calmed down. It was a two-party state. It soon became a one-party state, which happened in a number of places.
Yeah,
as you all know from Ghana.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's an interesting history, and you being there to witness that as well. And there are sides to it that I'm sure that there will be plenty of times to be able to dig deep into that. I could see your curiosity in this, Nick, in terms of independence, in terms of the colonization and how even, I think, one of the biggest topics is how the African continent was divided and who actually, you know, was actually done in a room in somewhere in Europe, you know, it just says, well, you have this, you have that, and then obviously the tribes were then, you know, so you could be living in Ghana, you know, sort of east of Ghana, and this is your whole tribe, and then there is a line between that, and then you become Togolese, and this person become your auntie becomes, you know, Ghanaian, and you're like, oh, hang on a minute, you know,
how did that happen?
So it is really, really interesting. It's not like, if you like, Europe, that basically, you know, obviously in Romanian times, and you know, it's sort of groups of people, you know, England becoming
more organic, wasn't it? Years and years.
Absolutely.
Warfare. Even allowing for that in Europe, I mean, in my time, we've gone from Yugoslavia, and we've got now half a dozen different.
In our time as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right. The lines were drawn all over Africa without any thought about what actually happened on the ground.
Yeah.
And that was all about wealth grab.
Wealth, yes. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. So, and the consequences will be played out for centuries.
It does. It does. And I mean, you know, it's we are trying not to get this into that political side of the podcast. But yeah, it's very interesting, and I'm glad in effect, you are Kenyan. You understand the whole thing from African point of view and from European point of view, which is very, very interesting.
Yeah, and going back to the question, you know, yes, certainly my parents and everybody else's parents were talking and were worried about it and were wondering what their future was. Us as kids, at a kids level, we would pick up on the conversation, and in reality, most kids reflected their parents' point of view. So we'd have it at a much lower level. But if your parents were gung-ho,
yes,
then I guess the kids were pretty gung-ho.
Of course. Yeah, yeah.
And if your parents are much more liberal-minded about it, the kids are probably. So yes, we had the conversations at those the levels, but at much lower level, shall we say.
And what was the vibe from your mum and dad?
That's very interesting, Bryn. I think if there weren't a couple of factors that came along that changed our thinking, but I think my parents were all for staying. And yep, if we go down the independence road, that's what we do. We stay here and we make the most of it. And, you know, because my dad, he'd been born and grown up in Africa, and he was much as an African as anybody else was.
Yeah.
And his family investment in the country was there. But just around about then, just before the late 50s, my mother contracted breast cancer, and that got dealt with, which was fine. And then just as we were coming up to independence, she got cancer moving into her lungs. Mm. And in reality, Nairobi wasn't the place to get it sorted. Mm. And she's an English girl, a nurse in this country, trained in this country, matron in this country in London, and then had gone abroad taking her skills with her, first to India and then to East Africa. And she wanted to come home and see the last of her years here, A, because of the medical situation, but B, because the rest of her family were here in the UK, apart from one who was in Ghana.
Oh really?
My aunt ended up running the libraries in Ghana.
Oh, brilliant! That's excellent.
Was that Evie?
Yeah, Eve. Yeah, she went out there after the war, having been a librarian in this country and gone up, went out there as independence came, Kwame Nkrumah asked her to stay on and head up the libraries.
That's interesting. I mean, the era, what you were talking about, is an era that I learned at school.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's really interesting to hear it from someone who actually experienced it.
Yeah.
You know, and what Kwame Nkrumah tried to do for the rest of the African states and trying to influence independence across.
Yeah.
And in a way, when you are younger, you are all for independence, because the way that it is actually explained to you is pretty much someone occupying your country.
Yeah.
Whilst it's actually, on the other hand, is actually someone, of course, is occupying, but also trying to run the country, because it was a business for the colonial masters. It was a business, and the more you run a good business, the better you are actually going to sustain. So there were elements of, obviously, infrastructures that were put in place, making sure there are schools, making sure basically running a country as if it is, you know, sort of European. The better your country is, the more you can actually benefit from it. I in my view, having grew up and obviously learned it better with life experience, I've realized that, you know, of course the Africans weren't ready to rule, and if there were a joint, if you like, partnership, some sort of longevity or element in governing together, then it would have really worked.
You're hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it? But in reality, what should have been done and done in a calm manner would be something along the lines of, yes, we're going to work towards independence. No, it's not going to be a rush. Yes, we're going to build up your experiences, not just at the top and at the bottom, but somebody in the middle learning what makes the whole damn thing work.
Works, yeah.
Yeah, and it should have been done over 20 or 30 years to give it half a chance. And in fairness, to people like Nkrumah, he actually had that vision.
Yeah.
But he had the vision that Africa should actually punch with all of its weight rather than its individual
weight. Yeah.
But he never got the chance. And he was ahead of his time.
He was. There was no way, you know, if you look at Africa now, even it's impossible.
Yeah.
And it has gone far, you know, it's more intellectuals, there's a lot more going on, a lot more roads, a lot more infrastructure for us to be able to do that. But the divide, the more developed countries are becoming, the more divide Africa is. And it is practically impossible. And I think Nkrumah's vision was brilliant. Just so you're aware, Kwame Nkrumah it was the first president for Ghana. I think he was the...
60, among, wasn't it? 1960.
So we gained independence in 1957.
Well, he must have been
So he came to power and he unfortunately was deposed on his travel to Europe. You know, the military just took over and he couldn't come back to Ghana as president. And it was really unfortunate. He spent quite a lot of his time trying to convince the rest of Africa to be independent so that they could join together.
Yeah.
And most of them weren't, you know, and he, of course, really was influential in Kenya. Independence, you know, influential in Nigeria, influential in Ivory Coast, you know, all the other African countries that, especially in the Western part. But it wasn't. What I find fascinating, just trying to bring it back to your life, is this. Growing up in a place like that, you know, surrounded by the most beautiful nature you can, it's just unbelievable experience, you know. I mean, what are some of the, if we go to the nice, lighter subject.
Great question. The politics it's been ticking over for me too. It's like, when did you see a lion? Have you had any encounters?
Have you had an encounter with a lion?
That's basically it, Has a lion chased you?
Several times. Being the warden, we ended up with getting things that people found dumped on us. So in the time that we were there, as my father, the whole family was there, we had, at different times, we had four lion cubs. We had numbers of cheetahs, only one leopard, and that was a fearsome thing. We had...
These are animals that you cared for?
Absolutely.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
The first lion cub it was brought in by an African. He was probably premature. Because he was found by the side of the path, leading up to a shamba, which is where all the vegetables were grown by the Africans, and there was no evidence of any other cubs there. And in fairness to the Africans, they brought him. They normally just banged him on the head, to be honest with you, but decided to take him up to mum and dad. And sure enough, he became part of the family. Wow. Very, very quickly. It was a lesson for us because we had never, you know, he was actually literally hours old when he came to us. Dad tried to take him back to where he was, tried to track the lioness and tracked her up, going up into the mountains in Ngong Hills, and even left him overnight. Hoping that the lioness would come back and collect him, but she obviously denned up somewhere, got other youngsters to worry about and forgotten all about him. So he ended
what,
up...
What was his name?
It was Prince.
That was Prince?
Yeah, that was Prince, yeah. And, yeah, he stayed with us about... He was 11 months when he left us and came back to this country to go to Edinburgh Zoo. And in those days, there was a industry of sending wild animals to zoos. Zoos weren't that bothered about breeding, et cetera, et cetera. They'd just send somebody out. Attenborough, for one, was one of the guys that used to collect animals and send them to zoos. So they give them a shopping list up. We need 4 lions, we need 12 giraffes. And these guys would disappear off into East Africa, come back and ship them all over. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, he had to go because at 11 months, bearing in mind I was 9 and my brother was 8, when he wanted to win an argument... He just had to sit on us, and that was it. The argument was over, he was actually hugely docile, a really friendly guy. He greeted everybody. He had a special greeting for the family every evening. He'd come into where we were sitting after we'd had our dinner. He'd bring in a Coke bottle, which he'd nicked out of one of the things. Bring it into the lounge. He'd put the Coke bottle down, then he'd go up to every person, and he'd jump up a bit, put his paws on your shoulders, and just put his head on yours and just give you a rub like that. And he went round the entire family doing that.
Wow.
And then settled down for the evening.
Wow.
And he, like all pets, he managed to get himself onto the sofa. And as he got bigger and bigger, he booted the other people off the sofa so that in the end, he owned the sofa.
He owned the sofa.
Yeah.
I mean that is
that's him. Yeah.
That is such an exciting. Oh blimey, that is something else. Yeah. You know, this is not. You know, like when you watch films, and you have Tarzan. You know, with all the animals, and you know, and the interesting thing that wild animals can actually really live quite peacefully.
Yeah.
With yourselves, is really, and so they've got the sense of smell, like most cats know who you are.
There's a sort of a fight finale to the tale. He eventually got back here. He went to Edinburgh Zoo. They put him on display there, and he eventually became top lion there and had a good life. But we went back to see him about a year or so after he'd left us. And the zoo director obviously made a fuss of us. And we went round to see him, and he was there in the cage. And the zookeeper said to him, "Do you want to go and see him?" And we thought, well, we don't want to upset him. But Dad couldn't help himself. He said, "Yeah, I wouldn't mind going in." All the crowd were there. We were just in front of the crowd in a special area. And then Dad went in with the zookeeper into the enclosure. And you could see everybody sort of going, what's going to happen next? Yeah. Most of the lionesses just pushed themselves to the far side. And Prince took one look and just ran down like a kitten that he had been. And came straight up and sort of pushed himself against Dad's legs and gave him the jump up and the head. So, yeah. And that was, put it this way, we couldn't get a word out of Dad because I think he was just so choked afterwards. But we promised ourselves we'd never do that again.
Yes.
Because it was upsetting for us, but it must have been for him.
For him as well. No, that's very interesting. That is absolutely brilliant story. Mm. You know, and I think you probably have quite relative stories around that. Some that were quite challenging.
Oh yes, I mean, dealing with any wild animal is difficulty. Is a difficulty. Number one, and with all of we learnt as we went along, but you know, trying to get, you think all you've got to do is put some milk in them, but it's not good enough. You know, they it's too rich. They sick it up, and then it starts slowly fade away. Yeah. So we had my mother, being a nurse, and we had an incredibly good vet along with us, and they all combined their knowledge and tried to find the right kind of formula to put into the different kinds of animals. And it's just silly little things, you know. You give a bottle to a baby and it's sick, that's fine. You give it a bottle to, I don't know, we say, a baby impala, and it sucks the teat off.
Yes.
And it's just, or you hold on to the teat, and the flow's not enough, so you have to open it up. Otherwise, it's sucking and sucking and just getting air. And,
yes.
And then the other end of the scale, you baby rhino, well, you have to use a bit of a bamboo thing and shovel it down that way. So it was always a bit touch and go. And there were some that we lost, there's no doubt about it. It was probably a good lesson for kids.
Yes.
Things don't last. But the converse of that was we had an amazing childhood.
Yeah.
All these things kept coming and going.
Yeah.
To the point that when I tell my grandchildren about it, you know, I've realized that I actually need to put these down so that actually the story goes on, and when I drop off my perch, somebody will be able to pick it up and still read about it. So, yeah, from that point of view. Mm. But we took it all for granted.
Mm.
This was what happened at home.
Yeah, because it's all you know. You didn't know how special that was at a time.
Yeah, I think we did. Compared to the other kids in school, not too many of them had lions. But it was part of the country. It's an exciting country. So things did happen in the country. But we were a little bit special in that our experience was even more intense than some of the other people's.
Mm-hmm.
When I look back, what a fascinating experience.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
And then your family moved to England.
Yeah.
And so what was your journey from sort of leaving Kenya to Sussex? What were the stops along the way?
Ooh, it's quite a twisty, turny road. it's a very short one in a very quick answer, in that my parents bought a place up near Banbury. Mm-hmm. And as my mother became more and more ill, we were spending more time in this country, and Dave and I were both in boarding schools in this country. But even before that, we came back on leave. Every other year, my parents got what was called home leave, which meant they could come back to the UK. And back in 1962, I think it was, we all came back on home leave. And on the home leave, you end up going around seeing all the aunts and the uncles and all this sort of thing and doing the family thing.
So you were very kind of familiar with England in that sense, or did England seem a little bit of a sort of a strange foreign land for you?
To be honest with you, Bryn, it was a place that both as kids we couldn't see the point of going there, to be honest. There was more fun to be had back home. And we had to take these bloody flights which go from Nairobi to Entebbe to Benghazi to Cairo to, it just went on and on and took about 14 days to get there. Mm. But slight exaggeration. But on this particular occasion, I think we were 11 and 12, something like that in age. The holiday ended with us being dumped in a school in East Grinstead, and that was my introduction to Sussex.
Wow.
We literally, my parents decided, we were going back. You know, we were going back to school back in Kenya, but Mum and Dad decided, right, well, you know, let's get the kids in here. It's going to happen sometime, so let's do it. And they literally, we went down to some shop, got measured up for kit for the school, and the next day we're dumped in the school. That was it.
Wow.
And was that, did that feel like an event, or did that feel like a real wrench for you? Still very young.
Yeah. I felt, we both did, Dave and I felt bereft because we weren't going to see my parents because they flew off a couple of days later back to Kenya. And but we were in this country which was cold, wet, etc.
Yeah.
Although Nairobi can be cold and wet, let's be honest. But the other thing was, and I was talking to my brother Dave about this literally the last couple of days, all the stuff that we'd learned in Kenya was totally irrelevant here, to here. All our history was about East African history. Yeah. Who the bloody hell was Henry VIII? French and Latin. What? What's all that about? And I can, English, you think, okay, I'll be okay with English. And he goes in, and the teacher was some kind of... Well, anyway, he had this... He had got his class having to learn lines and lines of The Ancient Mariner. And his opening bit at the beginning of term was each kid had to stand up and quote as many lines of The Ancient Mariner. And it came to my turn and I said, who the bloody hell is The Ancient Mariner? And I sort of a rap over the head, and there he is. And this time next week, you'll know a dozen lines. This is great.
Yeah.
Well, I know what's getting for your next birthday.
Yeah. Coleridge has always been in my heart.
And I guess you've gone from complete freedom to complete constraints of a rigid school.
Don't forget, you know, the schools in Kenya were boarding schools and trammelled, as all boarding schools are. The curriculum is, and every minute of your day is measured and expected to be done. But the other side, of course, was we were then half terms and things like that. We're dumped on aunts and things like that who didn't particularly want two little wild African gits running around their house. It was an interesting traumatic experience in many ways.
How old were you then, if you don't mind me asking?
12.
That is a really, I think, your formative year, having sort of learned quite a bit, you know, knowing who you are and what you like, you know, because I remember my going in junior secondary, you know, we call it at the age of 11, I pretty much knew almost everything. I remember that like yesterday, you know, I know what I was learning, what I liked, who my friends were. You know, so growing up like that over in Africa and then coming here, I mean, I relate to it slightly. I know we've touched this subject.
I think every kid has it. You go from being the fish, big fish, don't you, in primary school, and then you're suddenly in a bigger pond, and you're the little minnow.
Absolutely.
But this one... When you usually do that, you've got a few of your friends going alongside, so you're sharing the experience. In this particular case, it's just Dave and me.
Yes.
And with his completely different way of doing things.
Yes.
And I think 62, 63 was the hardest winter they'd had in this country for God knows how long. And that was our first serious English winter. To the point that I can remember... a stag coming up to the windows of the school to be fed bread because it just couldn't get anything to eat, and he used to come every morning just to get bread. That was chilblains and all of those good things suddenly came to life.
I mean, so obviously hijacking some of these questions a bit, and because it sounds really, turning point, you know, so you came, and I think probably eventually your parents move here.
My mum first came back because she was getting more and more ill, and Dad carried on working for a bit longer, so I was, I think, 15 by the time we finished in East Africa. But by then Dave and I moved on to other schools. We were getting anglicised, shall we say. But it was between two worlds. And it took some learning as to what was acceptable and what wasn't acceptable.
Yes. Yeah.
And without the sort of the support of your mates around you, which was... But in fairness, you know, kids are a lot more resilient than people actually think because they actually... You find a mate quickly or friends, and if you're good at something, you pick up other friends from that. So, yeah, you find your way, don't you?
Yeah.
It's that or...
Yes, of course, of course. I mean, that's the beauty of going somewhere when you're younger. You are able to do that. So, I mean, I know that's probably some of your questions. Going back, isn't it? Like, yeah. So, you've been here. When did you go back?
Okay. Yeah. Well, that was my first experience of Sussex. Yeah. Was the couple of years in East Grinstead. Is it in Sussex? I think it is. Yeah, we were there. So. Yeah, just about. After that, I went off to a school, Pangbourne, which is a naval college. I found out I was colorblind, so I couldn't go in the Navy. So then did an awful lot of jobs after. Eventually, back in about 1969, I ended up back in Sussex. I'd come up from Cornwall where I'd spent the summer, and I came here and did a job doing chicken catching, which was a really bizarre job to do and not recommended. but that brought me back to Sussex, I've been in and out of Sussex ever since then, sort of thing. Mm. So it's got to be one of my favourite places.
Yeah.
My first house was down in Rye, and now I'm in Wadhurst.
Excellent.
So,
and you lived in Ringmer.
And Ringmer, places like that. Burwash. So, yeah, there's a few places around and about. Mm. The southeast has been, sort of a stamping ground for me, and eventually I became a proper person and got a job in a bank and things like that. And that was all based down in the southeast, in Kent to begin with, and then the Sussex as well. This is my home now. Mm. Sussex is my home now. Mm. There's no doubt about it. But I don't mind going off to explore other places.
Yes. Yeah.
Which you did for a number of years. I mean, I think I've known you retire at least four or five times. And then restart various things. And you worked in the travel industry.
Yeah.
Sort of this end of your career.
Yeah.
Or recently, which afforded you a lot of opportunities. Where were you travelling?
I was exploring.
You were exploring.
For the customer.
Yeah. And was there anywhere in particular that you went that just really left an impression?
Yeah. A number of places. I really fell in love with Namibia in Southwest Africa.
Namibia?
Yeah. It's just a country the size of, France, with only about 2 million people in it. The wildlife and the geography and geology is just outstanding. And it's not blighted by a number of the things that blight a lot of African countries. It's got a lot going for it, and it is just a really great country. But more recently, I went to Costa Rica. I really enjoyed that. I like the fact that they're really wanting to be carbon neutral, and they should be around about now. And got to be one of the first countries to get there, of a decent size, shall we say.
Mm. What's propagated that in Costa Rica?
Ambition. Mm. Number one, they haven't got an army.
Right.
That was a very conscious decision. They've seen what's happened in all the other countries around and about. The army keeps taking over and screwing up the country. And they very consciously said, right, we won't have an army. The money we'll save on that we'll put into wildlife. And they are blessed. You know, they've got plenty of volcanoes and that sort of stuff to give them heat and light. But they're into making sure that they get carbon neutral as fast as they can be. Mm-hmm. And looking after the diversity of the country. Mm-hmm. And are doing a brilliant job. Mm-hmm. Then the other place that I really fell in love with was Uganda. I went back to Uganda after so many years. And, of course, Uganda's had its problems. Mm. And, you know, you go and see three or four very tame rhino, and that's all that we used to be there, when you consider what it used to be like. But go to some of the places like the national parks there, and the game is coming back. If you leave it, it will come back. Mm-hmm. And they're beginning to get the elephants with decent tusks, and the numbers are picking up and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then I had the huge privilege of doing a trek into the impenetrable forest and seeing the gorillas there. And one of my life's ambition was to be charged by a gorilla, and it happened.
Oh, wow. Tell us about that.
In fairness, it shouldn't happen. So it's not something to be proud of.
Okay.
You go up, they give you a good talk before, and if you've got any chance of having a headache or anything like that, you're not going. It's as simple as that. If you're not fit.
Mm. Is this the altitude?
You can actually pass on all the diseases onto the gorillas. Okay. So they don't. Okay. They're not taking any chances. And, of course, for every person that goes, there's at least one or two guides going with you, because it's hard going. But then, you know, the sweat's pouring off you, you're wet, soaking through, and all the rest of it. And then suddenly you come over the brow of a ridge, and there's a gorilla sitting there with picking flowers out of their tree and just munching away. And you think, oh, that's really...
Wow.
But the guy that I was with, he said, oh, come with me, you get some better photos. And we went round to the side of where the others were, and we must have overstepped the mark, because the big guy suddenly was up and charging us. And they had said, you've got to stand your distance. And I did. I stood rigid and let him come. And he came up, good stare in the eyes, and then walked off. And I thought, oh, I can relax. And then he turned around and did it again. Just stood there and... Then he went, and then after that, he lay in the sun.
That's been terrifying,
though. That is terrifying.
But
were you confident? Because I guess you have some experience with animals.
With all animals.
Yeah. Okay. Don't give them... So did that kick in?
It did. Yeah. And we'd had the talk. So
yeah. Okay.
So long as you remember what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, I would have found that pretty.
Yeah. Yeah. I would have found, because the natural instinct is to turn around and start running.
It is. Yeah. And that's what you should never do with anything or any animal, really.
Right. Most of them can run faster than us.
Exactly. So yeah. And you're giving them your back, so it makes it an easy target, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And whilst we are not. That we're trying to find our times, you got chased by animals. Yeah. But whilst we're on that subject, when did you get chased by either a lion or a tiger?
Lions, not so often, because they're actually quite lazy beasts.
Right.
There was one occasion when Dave and I were biking around near our house in the park, and a tourist pulled up alongside us. He realised there's some lion down the corner, just round the corner. Yeah, we know about that. And he drove off, so we carried on biking, and sure enough, there were some lions there. And they were in hunting mode, so we had to turn around and bike like hell to get out of it.
Gosh.
And how about rhino? Any rhino?
In those days, rhinos were pretty frequent beasts that you could meet. And my dad had this habit of he would actually blow on his arm to make the noise of a rhino. And because they're so short-sighted, we would be sitting in this rhino, this Land Rover, and he'd make this noise. And sometimes they'd just look and think, oh, it's that silly sod Ellis with his... He thinks he's a rhino. A rhino. Yeah, we know he isn't. But then occasionally they're just... all right, well, we'll have him. And they give it, put in a little charge. And we usually got out of the way without any trouble. But there was one occasion when he stalled, and it did hit us. And Dave and I were on the back of the Land Rover on one of these sort of low-level back ones, and it knocked Dave out the back, and I had to pull him back into the
But I hope he said thank you.
He's eternally grateful.
Yeah.